Good morning. You're listening to KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio. You're also listening to Praxis. I'm your host, Taylor. I'm back live in the studio after a quick break last week. Played an old show, hopefully an old but good show. I think it was pretty good. That's why I played it again. But today, I want to talk about, we're coming to the end of the year, whatever that means. I like New Year's a lot. People tend to be at their best right after that because they've just set all these resolutions, and it'd be cool if people did that all the time. They don't always, but it tends to be a good time of the year, and reflection is important for people or groups of people, entire societies who are interested in growing, not necessarily growing bigger, but growing better. So I'm thinking some reflection might be in order about the year we just had and what it all means, man. So if you have anything you want to weigh in on related to that, you can always call in to the show live. If the timing is right, I'll take your call. The timing will almost certainly be right because I'll make it work. Number to call is 509-747-3807 if you'd like to weigh in. So it was a long year for me, and it was a long year in the world, and there was a lot going on. So I decided to start. I had ideas in my mind for what my top stories were, just based on things that I helped, that I worked on this show, people I interviewed, recurrent issues. But I thought I'd look at what the biggest stories of the year were according to the mainstream media. So I found a couple sites that had kind of a month by month play-by-play of what was going on, and the things that came up are the things that you would expect, and I finally pinpointed why they're things that aren't very interesting to me, and I'll get that to that in a minute. But back in January, so a lot of the things that are focused on when you look at world news are various conflicts around the world. So France's incursion into Mali, the U.S. played no small part in the beginning of the year, which many people, myself included, may have forgotten about in all the constant chatter of bad things happening in other places, which is what I would characterize most world news as. Egypt, protests in Egypt, not covered very well necessarily by the U.S. media, but definitely covered, which is a strange thing to give a lot of time to something and do so poor a job with the analysis. But I guess that's just how things are sometimes. And Syria was probably one of just the top words, top places in the world that folks were focused on in 2013, with everything escalating there to the eventual accusations of chemical weapons, to Obama requesting power to launch a full-scale military operation, which didn't eventually end up happening, but there's all kinds of things going on in the background, as there generally are. The so-called resumption of peace talks between Israel and Palestine, which were hot on people's radar. Nothing incredibly new happened there. There's still a lot of compromises that won't be made. There was a new investigation into Arafat's death and showed that poisoning was probably likely. I got to understand that conflict a lot better this year, having gone over in May, possibly to go again in the future. But more of the same, but I think there's a growing understanding. It may just be my growing understanding that's making me believe that. But we'll see how that unfolds in this next year. Hugo Chavez's death and the subsequent, his replacement and Chavez dying kind of sparked up a lot of dialogue again about Latin America in general and what the relationship is with the U.S. The specific site that I was on classified different events. They had a section for world news, a section for U.S. news, a section for business. And the only thing in the business section for each month of 2013 was the numbers about jobs. So jobs continue to be something that people love to talk about, but not talk very meaningfully about. I just brought up the other day on this show, I believe, I don't have another one, so it must have been here, that My husband shared a really good podcast with me about the, you know, this problem with the so-called millennials, which is the generation I'm part of, I suppose. And that, you know, they don't want to get jobs and this and that. And the person interviewed pointed out that a lot of the jobs that we have that are available really aren't necessary. They're kind of being kept around out of custom, you know, because people just have to work for 40 hours a week. That's just how we do things. And that's not true in other types of cultures. That's not true in other so-called modern societies. So we didn't have we had an okay dialogue about jobs, but it was mostly just about metrics. It was more jobs, better. And somehow the number of jobs grew and unemployment also grew. So I don't really ever want to be an economist. I have no interest in understanding the complex formulas that are used to justify lots of silliness, in my opinion. But jobs were still hot in 2013. Thankfully, locally, something I'll talk about more when I get to local stuff, the new economy concepts, I think, picked up some steam here as part of the new economy summit in April of 2013. And people who met there are still working on projects, working on worker-owned cooperatives, working on just workers' rights in general, better jobs, jobs that make sense, that fill actual needs in the community without destroying the planet. Really radical concepts like that. So kudos to those folks. That's still rolling. So changing the jobs dialogue a little bit. And one thing I thought was hilarious on this site that I was looking at with this current event, you know, list rundown, the word they used, NSA leaks about the NSA program causes strain, which I thought was kind of an understatement. It talked about Russia giving asylum to Edward Snowden and how that strained the U.S. and Russian relationship. And then the following four headlines were NSA leaks also cause strain in U.S. relationship with Germany. NSA leaks also cause strain with, it was, so they use this word strain over and over again. The U.S. stomping all over the place with its surveillance equipment. Surprisingly, other people weren't very happy about that. And that was a big story. I remember right when I came back from my trip to Palestine in May, I had missed that. When I was gone, I wasn't really reading news from other parts of the world. I didn't really have energy or time. And I was writing and developing pictures and staying up late into the night doing that. So the first really major English language newspaper I saw again when I came back through Washington, D.C., no, in Frankfurt, Germany, was a big picture. Now I'm blanking on her name, but those leaks had just been made. And there was a lot of hysteria about protecting America and how whistleblowers are evil people and need to be chased around the world. So it was a year of whistleblowing, 2013. It was a year of various uprising around the world, something I'll talk about a little more on kind of a positive spin. None of these lists that I saw, shockingly, and I only looked at a couple, to be fair. I didn't put a lot of time into my mainstream media analysis today. But Chelsea Manning's trial, nowhere in sight on this list. Very strange. I thought that was probably one of the more important world events, at least U.S. events of the year. But it just wasn't talked about. So I guess once you're in jail, you don't have to exist anymore, and that's okay. So those are the main, I'm trying to think if I've forgotten anything. That's what I wrote down. JP Morgan Chase paying $14 billion back to the U.S. government. Kind of just a strange case at this point. The money going back and forth and all of that, but that made the list too. So my favorite stories, I can't decide if I want to start at the top or the bottom of my list. One of, this isn't a story, but it's an idea that that gave me a lot of hope as a person who is not interested in a strong role for the state or for capitalism. When the two interact, we see that there are terrible results. nearly always. And a lot of my frustration, having been in the world of activism, is the focus on using the legal system, because it seems pretty arbitrary. When you see, having taken democracy school, gone to the Daniel J. Pennock Democracy School pretty young, I went the first time at 18 and then I went again to a miniature one. They put a whole different spin on the framing of the Constitution, who was in the room, old white guys who owned land, who was not in the room, everyone else. That's not their focus, but that was something I really noticed for the first time. I noticed what all the implications of that were, that the people who own land and assets write the laws. It seems like that could pretty easily go wrong, and it has in a lot of ways. But Democracy School kind of shares how within the framework of the Constitution, there was a lot of room intentionally for business, for incorporated wealth, the corporate body, to have a lot of power and to have access to systems that are supposedly for citizens, meaning individual people. So having read things like Howard Zinn, People's History of the United States, just, and really realizing, thinking about being in that time, being a woman, being anyone but one of these land-owning white men, who were only 15 to 20% of the population of the colonies, not counting displaced indigenous people or killed. So anyway, that whole idea of having an elite class write the laws makes the laws not something I have a lot of respect for as a general rule. But then, you know, we have this narrative in this country, and in some ways, at least on paper, there have been gains in the ways we do law in the U.S. Everyone, in theory, is included now, except for children. And that makes the problem seem like it's gone. But when you have concentrated wealth like you have in this country, and you have a structure, you know, based on representation, and because of the concentrated wealth, not everyone has access to that representation, it totally nullifies the whole thing. And this year, I think that became more obvious than ever, that the laws in this country just don't matter if you have money or if you have power outside of money. They really don't matter. And there are many examples of this, which some of which overlap with other things I want to talk about. So one of those is just the failure. This was more 2012, but continued into 2013. It's been the story of my entire life, of the last 25 years at least, and back into the 80s as well. The utter failure of global climate negotiation, climate talks, to come up with some simple legislation, some simple agreement that people like the U.S. people, that nations, governments like that of those of U.S. and China will actually agree to. It should be pretty simple. Oh, we need to keep our planet from being destroyed. Let's make some baseline agreements about what we won't do based on the scientific evidence of what is harmful to the planet. But that failed. The structures that we have to do things like that, the UN, most of the international bodies that we have for that, are totally bullied and railroaded by the same handful of more powerful, more wealthy nations that they always have been, which kind of eliminates their purpose in many ways. If the point of representing everyone is to represent everyone equally, you can't have the types of weighted systems that we do there. But so that's one that isn't really completely related to what I want to say about laws and laws mattering less this year, or being more apparent that they matter less this year. But that's kind of some of the overarching framework I'm talking about. A big one that I talked about on this show that I interviewed Kristen Beefus about is the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That is a big, gnarly trade deal going on between the nations of the Pacific Rim, including the U.S., going on completely in secret, was barely reported at all in the media. And when it was in praise because it's going to do these great things for the economy. It's going to create jobs, and jobs are the thing we want to talk about. But it also was just this, it's a very strange umbrella, including a lot of laws that have nothing to do with trade, ostensibly. Basically, it includes a provision that's more or less, why can't I remember the acronym I'm trying to remember, that locks down the internet to a large degree, locks down freedom of information online, which is something folks should know about and pay attention to. Should have more information than I just did a second ago. But so it includes provisions about copyright and copyright infringement that have a lot of implications online. It includes loopholes in environmental laws, in labor laws. So basically any work that the, you know, quote unquote, developing nations on the Pacific Rim have done for labor standards, any work that people in the U.S. want to do to support workers elsewhere, you know, manufacturing jobs that have been outsourced, is just completely trampled by this really unilateral set of laws. And they aren't technically laws, it's a trade deal, but basically a corporate entity would override any of these states that exist. So it's basically a formalization of what the arrangement already appears to be in the world. Large corporations really are what drive global events via the economy much more than governments. You know, the only governments that survive are ones that are complicit with this global capitalist model of growth forever and unilateral power. And if your state doesn't play with that, then you tend to get squashed by the other states that are really married to that concept, such as the U.S. So TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, basically just formalizes this arrangement of market over government, over people, and over actual, over ecology, over systems that make sense. And since it's being negotiated in secret and, you know, it's not something anyone's going to get to vote on, it's becoming more and more absurd to suggest to people that they vote to change something, which for me is good news because it means that people can expand their imaginations to the myriad other possibilities for changing the world that there are outside of voting. You're never going to get to vote yes or no for capitalism, even with your dollar. So TPP is the macro example of laws not mattering. We have, you know, as long as we have concentrated wealth, it doesn't really matter if we have representative democracy, because we saw in Washington State yet again, after seeing it in Costco buying the liquor initiative a couple years ago. Now we have booze in the grocery stores. Hurrah, I suppose. Costco bought that election, and at that point, it was the most heavily funded state campaign, with Costco pouring millions of dollars into it, largely Costco and a few other entities, the grocery associations and those folks. This year in Washington, again, GMO labeling was defeated despite broad grassroots support by, you know, the handful of chemical companies you would expect, Monsanto, Dow, the whole gang. There's six companies poured over like tens of millions of dollars into this state campaign against GMO labeling to put out all kinds of messaging. It was pretty brilliant in some ways because it targeted everybody. It made you, there was a way, I saw a lot of people who, if I had talked to them before the campaign started, would totally support labeling GMOs. And talking to them afterwards, these campaigns put together by these chemical companies and their marketing firms had these people convinced that they were actually too smart to fall for this specific initiative, and that, you know, it's not perfect, all of this. And they also played into the folks, you know, saying this is going to ruin traditional farming. It's going to ruin jobs, you know, the jobs again. And GMO labeling was defeated in Washington by incorporated wealth. So the no campaign for 522 had a total of $900 in contributions from individuals across the state. And the yes campaign was almost entirely from individuals. And that's just how elections are going to work, unfortunately, as long as, you know, people are focused on doing their part by voting every couple years, and, you know, just only paying attention during the month before that time, during which there's all kinds of money being poured into messaging that there isn't the rest of the year. So money in politics made our laws ineffective. The structure itself of global capitalism made our laws ineffective. And locally, our supposed lawmaking power as citizens was highly ineffective this year. And there's a lot going on with that. It's something I've talked about on the show quite a bit, so I don't want to belabor it too much. But was that this year? Well, it was at the end of last year. But the Community Bill of Rights being kept off of the ballot despite qualifying as a local initiative by the city council, this kind of preemptive vote to keep it off the ballot after it had already met all of the qualifications, that was pretty unprecedented here. And, it's pretty much a slap in the face to people who really believe in this process. For me, the initiative process was kind of the last thing that I was willing to be like, yeah, that's fine. It's not, it's not a representative office that can be bought. It's a group of people getting together, writing down an idea that they like and that they think would help people, like the Community Bill of Rights or like something more simple, like a school levy, and getting people doing the work to get people to support it and educate people about it and then putting it to a vote. I don't really have a problem with that fundamentally, but apparently the majority of our city council people did, and people were fairly accepting of it. You know, oh, well, they must just be smarter than us. They have the lawyers, and they know. They know what's good for us, and that's just not an attitude that's going to get anyone anywhere positive. We also had and still have, up until today, our problems with police accountability in Spokane. I was thinking that, you know, this idea of having police oversight, we all voted for it in the initiative process. By we all, I mean almost 80% of voters in Spokane voted for independent oversight via an ombudsman. We've had all this drama. I had Liz Moore on talking about it. I had Tim Connor on talking somewhat about it, also about journalism in general and the coverage of this. From yesterday, Doug Clark actually wrote a piece on it here, which I'll just read for you because it's short. So we can have a quick update on this ombudsman light is what he calls it, which I am fond of. But this was just a huge, huge overstep by the mayor's office, mostly by the mayor's office and the police guild, which is just a shocking combination of people to perform oversteps around here. But here's what Doug Clark has to say about it. It's a big moment at City Hall on Monday night as members of the Spokane City Council plan to vote on Mayor David Condon's proposed ordinance about independent police oversight, which essentially amounts to, knock, knock, who's there? Police ombudsman. Police ombudsman who? Exactly. Most right-thinking residents, those not peeking out of the mayor's suit pocket, consider the Condon approach to be weak cheese. If you haven't been following the soap opera, you should know that the ombudsman was originally intended to be someone who could independently investigate citizen complaints of police abuse once all the bandages were removed. The ombudsman movement stems from the 2006 death of Otto Zem, who died after making the fatal mistake of attempting to buy some soda and a candy bar in a North Division convenience store. Erroneously reported as an ATM thief, Zem was beaten to a pulp and stun-gunned by this cop who decided that thuggery would be better than wasting a lot of time asking the man a few questions. 7 years later, Spokane still doesn't have a real ombudsman. This is mainly due to resistance from La Capa Nostra, the city's powerful organized crime cabal that is sometimes called the Police Guild. Enter the Condon Compromise. Unfortunately for the mayor, most of the 80 people who showed up at a town hall meeting the other night were there to remind him that there's a reason Spokane hasn't had a two-term mayor since Riverside was a cow path. One of the critics, Deb Conklin, hi Deb, went so far as to quote Bob Dylan's Blowin' in the Wind, saying, "How many deaths will it take till he knows that too many people have died?" I love Dylan, but with all due respect to Conklin, this is not the lyric I would have pulled out to describe the mayor's waffling. The line that pops into my noggin is the opening of Positively 4th Street, which goes, "You got a lot of nerve to say that you're my friend." What a lot of us find annoying is how far the mayor has strayed from the tough talk he used a couple years ago when he was out seducing the citizenry for votes. Candidate Condon's position back then was essentially, "I'll not only give the ombudsman real juice, but every now and then I'll let him tie the worst Police Guild rascals to a tree for several days at a time." Then Condon won the election and came down with a case of ombudsmanesia. Maybe several of the Police Guild's larger members dropped by City Hall to educate the mayor on the ABCs of Spokane police relations, which are A, don't mess with the Police Guild, B, don't even think about messing with the Police Guild, when in doubt, consult A and B. Whatever happened, the mayor folded like a soft taco. When his earlier attempt to have the ombudsman replaced with a new Keurig coffee maker failed, Condon came up with the ombudsman light that the council must now vote on. How that will turn out is anybody's guess. That said, Council President Ben Stuckert has indicated that he'd rather poke his eyes out with a sharpened pencil than go along with the mayor's wimpishness. If the ordinance fails, however, rumor has it that the Police Guild will back the mayor on an even simpler ombudsman ordinance, which is rule number one. For better transparency, the Spokane Police Ombudsman will get a corner office with lots of windows. Pretty cute. So that's Doug Clark updating that tonight is going to be that talk and vote at City Council. There are folks organizing to wear red and show up at that at 6. But yet another example of what you vote for not often being real, not having the results that folks might have hoped. So, sorry, I was reading a comment on Facebook from a listener. Can't read and speak at the same time, it turns out. We'll work on that for 2014. Let's see, we're about halfway through. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Praxis on KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio, us being me and myself, talking about the top stories of 2013. So my story number one, the laws don't matter around here. And I don't know how a person would measure this, probably by doing exhaustive surveys, but I hope that all of this nonsense, all these shenanigans on a local level, state level, national level, global level, will just cause people to lose more faith in the superstitions that we hold as a nation. That, you know, we have the best system on earth and that it's infallible and that the people have a voice in it. It's just less and less true all the time. And I think more people get it. And I think more people who have gotten it for a while are starting to take the steps that need to be taken to just stop doing the silliness and start trying some other things. So, hurrah. I believe that's happening more and more, though I can't measure it or prove it. I think I'm reading my notes that I made earlier of other top stories. One of my top story headlines was "Meaning is dead." When nothing is real or serious, do people lose their ability to discern what is going on? I think that's true. That's a rhetorical question for me. I will read you what I was talking about. There's just so many, and not everyone has lost this ability, because I see people share things like this on Facebook, for instance, and, a large corner of the internet is dedicated to pointing out hypocrisy. But it just seems like people are really muted to the reality of life. Maybe it's from so much digital immersion. Maybe it's from just being desensitized by the sheer volume of data that we're exposed to every day. But there is some crazy, crazy stuff going on all the time. And people are like, oh, yeah, well, stuff's crazy. Stuff's just always crazy. And it doesn't really fully impact them in the way that it needs to for understanding to happen. So here's a nice tidbit of that just from a few days ago. This is a quote from December 10th, about a week ago, from Barack Obama. He says, quote, "There are too many leaders who claim solidarity with Mandela's struggle for freedom, but do not tolerate dissent from their own people." Do we know who any of those people are, Mr. Obama? So this is, and this is on kind of like a meme image thing on Facebook that I'm looking at. But underneath that, it has a photo of Chelsea Manning in prison for exposing war crimes. Thomas Drake, persecuted for exposing misuse of taxpayers' money. John Curacao, in prison for exposing the use of waterboarding. Edward Snowden, persecuting for exposing privacy violations. So one example, a friend of mine who shared this also shared another wonderful Obama quote about Israel. He said, quote, "No country on earth would tolerate missiles raining down on its citizens from outside its borders." So hopefully the hypocrisy there is obvious to everyone. But that's just one of a lot of examples. My other recent favorite example of meaning being dead and irony being just misused to the point of losing most of its punch. I went and saw the new Hunger Games film the other day. And for folks who don't know, that's basically the story of a central empire state, the capital, with its districts who had previously rebelled, who now, you know, pay tribute in children to this system at the center, retribution for their rebellion. Things are kind of cropping up again. But anyway, the capital is the U.S. for all intents and purposes. It's the wealthy elite in the center who are very distracted by fashion and colorful accessories and every type of food you could desire, all the things that we have here in the empire. And you know, it's not meant to be something to ooh and ah at in a realistic way. And I've seen a lot of articles saying like, ooh, what's the influence of the design of the Hunger Games on fashion in the U.S. It's like, really, guys, that's a little tacky. And taking it to new heights, in the previews for that film, CoverGirl has a collection of garishly colored makeups inspired by the residents of the Capitol called the Capitol Collection. And it ran right before the beginning of this movie about, you know, rising up against the oppression of the empire. And I thought it was pretty hilarious. It's like, wow, people are going to see that and buy it and not think about that at all. Maybe some people will. That's what Chris thankfully pointed out to me. He said, maybe there is someone in there who's sneaking that out with kind of a wink, hoping that people see the wink. But that's the best case scenario. So, yeah, I think a lot of things lost their meaning this year, and I hope that we can get some of that back. There's a lot of good art being made right now, thankfully, and I think that's the main role of artists, is to remind us what reality is, and that reality is shaped by a lot of different ideas, but most of them are just ideas. I think in an unfortunate way, climate change is going to remind us, and is already reminding people in other parts of the world, that you live on a planet, and you should try to get along. You should try to do what would the planet do? You should do that more than you do. So I think we'll be reminded in a lot of ways of what's real. I'm hoping this was just kind of a weird... This culture's going through some weird stuff, is really what I'm saying. We're going through some... whatever the opposite of growing pains are. And it's pretty strange, and a lot of weird stuff is coming out of it. So I guess we can just revel in the weirdness and see what happens next and try to be good people. So one of my other top stories, I heard more of the F word being feminism this year than I think I ever had before in my whole life. And it could be partially the circles I'm running in, but I really think that feminism has ascended a little I wrote in parentheses, again, my notes are really, really great here. Feminism ascends a little and mainstreams a little. I've had a lot more complex conversations with people I know in real life on a local level. It wasn't always positive, but I think the fact that the nuance was there is positive. It wasn't just, oh, feminists want to burn bras and, you know, oh, those feminists are really angry. The conversation went beyond that in a lot of ways with, you know, expanding the conversation around transgender people, expanding the conversation around just what are feminists, rape culture, like that phrase entering the lexicon wasn't on this list. I'm going to read some highlights of, but that's big on my list, I think. There was a lot of, unfortunately, a lot of the reasons this all happened was it was reactionary. There were a lot of horrible things going on as far as men around the world continuing to push just overtly bad and hateful agendas onto more than half of the Earth's population. But on a positive note, I found from a site I don't generally like very much, but it's okay, policymike.com. They did a most iconic feminist moments of 2013. I'm not going to read all of them, but there were some good ones. I guess this is another Hunger Games tie-in. Jennifer Lawrence said in an interview, her superiors, someone threatened to fire her if she didn't lose some weight. She's not a large woman. She was really angry. She told a magazine that if anyone even tries to whisper the word diet, I'm like, you can go expletive yourself. It's pretty cool. She's, you know, as far as this culture, we look up to celebrities, we being the royal we of U.S. culture. And I'm glad there's at least a few people out there throwing that out. There was a very fiery response to, I don't want to read about that part. A lot of this is entertainment related stuff, which I think is fine. I don't know if Beyonce coming out as a feminist is a big deal in my life, but, so a lot of this is about, actresses, others, stepping up and saying, yeah, I am a feminist. There was, Malika Sherawat is a Bollywood actress, and a female reporter asked her, told her that she was offended by her comment that India is regressive and depressive. This woman responded, she said, as a woman, should I lie about the state of women that's in my country? She said, with female feticide, infanticide happening on an almost daily basis, with gang rapes making the headlines of almost every newspaper, with honor killings, I'm going to bring up that this is regressive and depressive. So India was the site actually of a lot of feminist uprising. The Red Brigade is not on this list. A little more radical than I think this site wants to get. But women in India who are really just done with their, you know, sisters and mothers and friends facing sexual violence all the time in India, basically just formed a huge gang and were going out and to bring justice to the perpetrators of all these crimes, because the police predictably were not responding effectively. Partially, you know, in co-happening with that, the parliament in India passed an anti-rape bill that doubled punishments, but that doesn't change, you know, enforcement very much. Mindy, this is a good quote. Mindy Kaling, who I'm not familiar with because I just don't know stuff about pop culture. Sorry. But this is a great quote. I need to find out more about her. She said, I always get asked, where do you get your confidence? I think people are well-meaning, but it's pretty insulting because what it means to me is you, Mindy Kaling, have all the trappings of a very marginalized person. You're not skinny. You're not white. You're a woman. Why on earth would you feel like you're worth anything? And I just think it's exciting that that quote was in Parade magazine. So it means my grandma read it, which is pretty cool. Wendy Davis's filibuster is on here in Texas after Republicans tried to pass some pretty gnarly anti-choice bills. She filibustered the heck out of it. And that got tampons banned from the Capitol building in Texas, which is also very exciting, and that spawned some great humor men as feminists became a bigger topic. It became kind of controversial in some circles, men being fake feminists. The term mansplaining was invented this year, to my knowledge. Men explaining things about women's realities to women. More entertainment stuff. They point out Malala Yousafzai's speech, which later on, she didn't get Person of the Year, but she, you know, Nobel Prize and all that. Her speech was there. Solidarity is for white women was a hashtag on Twitter. It's so weird that that's news, but it's also very cool. I'm glad to see a conversation somewhat locally, but in the mainstream of feminism, talking about intersectionality, created by Mickey Kendall. The Solidarity is for White Women hashtag was designed to prompt a conversation about the exclusion of voices of color in the feminist movement. It trended in four continents at times, reaching up to 50 tweets a minute, which is pretty cool. 50 people a minute talking about, you know, intersectionality and women of color being prime, you know, being central to real effective feminism. So DOMA and Prop 8 were struck down on the same day. I don't, you know, we're talking about laws earlier, but that's on this list. There were a lot of great parodies of bad laws and bad ideas. Funny women everywhere parodying things that aren't really funny, kind of the painful funny. I don't remember what that's called, but Zerlina Maxwell's interview on Hannity was awesome. She was invited to speak about guns, rape, and violence. I'm just going to read this right from Policy Mike. As a rape survivor, she had a lot of notable reasons to shame conservatives who believe the solution to ending rape resides in giving out more guns. She said, quote, "I think the entire conversation is wrong. I don't want anybody telling women anything. I don't want women, I don't want men to be telling me what to wear, how to act, not to drink, and I don't honestly want you to tell me that I need a gun in order to prevent my rape." After her segment, she was attacked with a slew of racist online rape and death threats, but still managed to keep her cool. She's a troll pulverizer, and if you try to mess with her, you should watch out. She was very cool. They talk about Marissa Alexander was released from jail. She was a Jacksonville mother of three, sentenced to 20 years in prison for shooting a warning shot. You may have recalled that this trial overlapped with George Zimmerman being acquitted for shooting Trayvon Martin dead. Meanwhile, a black woman in the South gets 20 years for shooting a warning shot, not into a human being, just into a ceiling, her own ceiling, damaging her own house, using Stand Your Ground as a defense. So her sentence has now been overturned. She's been released. She's awaiting a new trial. So partial win. There were wins in getting Facebook to add gender-based hate speech and sexual violence threats to their block categories, so you can't threaten to rape someone on Facebook without consequences anymore. And I suppose that's a win. Another pop culture thing that I'll admit being fascinated with, I guess I'm really outing myself as a pop culture person after all today, but Orange is the New Black premiered. It's really one of the only really nuanced television shows about women I've ever seen. I guess if you put women in prison, they can't talk about clothes the whole time. So that's cool. And Laverne Cox stars in that, the first trans woman of color to have a leading role on a mainstream television show. Gloria Steinem got a medal from President Obama, which symbolic, but woohoo. So the feminism, I think, reached more people this year. That was exciting. My top story, my very number one, very underreported, but very heartening and promising story. It's really a collection of thousands and thousands of stories, which is why it's so cool, is Indigenous resistance to fossil fuel extraction and global capitalism in general. Finally, getting more space. I think that people Indigenous people around the world, in the U.S., everywhere, have always been strong voices of opposition to this destructive, psychotic culture that has a home here. But there hasn't been room, because there have been a whole lot of probably well-meaning colonial folk who wish to put their own solution first and kind of forget the lessons that a lot of other people who, you know, survived on this planet for millions of years without hurtling us into catastrophe might have to offer. So that was awesome. And I mean, it is awesome. It's something that's happening right now. And I have a whole bunch of information about it that I just have to open up. But I just, my own background being somewhat in the environmental realm, and just seeing pretty quickly, and just being disappointed in the lack of effectiveness, the overwillingness to compromise. I just don't think that you can have global capitalism and industrial civilization and a healthy planet. And that's just like the sacred cow that you can't discuss if you want to be a mainline environmental activist. And the push from movements like Idle No More being a big kickoff to this, but also just kind of a signal for many other Indigenous people and groups and groups in solidarity with these people to say no, we need to do things in a completely different way, and we need to stop doing this crazy stuff. We don't need to ask nicely, we just need to stop. And that was really, really cool. It was in the same, I guess, the Sierra Club really rendered itself insignificant to me this year. They just seem very tepid. Michael Bruni, who's the executive director, there was this big statement issued. He got arrested at the White House. And I talked about this on the show when it happened. But it was like this big deal. And all these places were writing about, like, wow, what a radical step for the Sierra Club to engage in this kind of civil disobedience. And, you know, it's really not radical to go to, because the main, the tactic of the environmental movement, the mainstream environmental movement, I should say, there are groups who are definitely exempt from this, who did a little more direct types of action, is to, you know, explain to the people in power that they've made a mistake. Explain it to them and show them that it's bad, and they'll change their mind because they just have to, because it's wrong. And unfortunately, that's true. It is wrong. You know, the things that these people do are wrong. But they don't seem to care. There's not really an incentive to change the behavior. There is if you're sane, but these people are not sane. I think that's just a safe statement to make. My partner got in an argument with someone about that the other day, about whether or not the people, quote unquote, in charge in this country are sane. And they're clearly not. The goals of growth forever, capitalism, and states that support that at all costs, including like military cost in people's lives and the well-being of the ecosystems we depend on, those people are not sane. Sorry, if you want to tell me they are, I will also inform you that you may need to examine your own level of sanity. Anyway, that's a tangent. But to be arrested at the White House is simply the culmination of that tactic. It's not a different tactic. It's not a radical tactic. It's just telling the guy in charge that he's wrong in the most dramatic way that you can. And it's not really a change. There was a lot of refreshing change, though, and that's my top story that I want to talk about. On a note, I was looking for that story. I was looking for the details of Michael Bruni's arrest when I was researching this show. And I have a note on my notes that says, what happens when you Google Sierra Club radical? I Googled Sierra Club radical. And it's actually, it's a reality check for me. What I consider radical and what the conservative and mainline press consider radical are very different. They say that the Sierra Club even mentioning that we need to get off of fossil fuels completely is radical. So anyway, reality check. Sometimes good, often depressing. I discovered one of my new favorite news sources in 2013, intercontinentalcry.org. They do an amazing job covering all things, all news indigenous. They just started a magazine. They are online, in print, on Facebook, all of that. Intercontinentalcry.org. Very good. And they put together their featured story right now. Very handy for me doing this countdown is 25 stories of indigenous resilience that you might have missed in 2013. So this isn't even focusing on resistance, but resilience, on building back up the power of people's culture that is not dead, despite many efforts to extinguish it. So there's all kinds. I'm going to put a link to this because I can't read it all, but a lot of it is about different indigenous nations and people making links with one another, building new or reviving old alliances in this sort of global struggle against psychotic behavior. So that happened between the Ainu and the Maori people in New Zealand. They did an exchange and a big project about it. Alternative currency in multiple tribes occupying Brazil's House of Representatives. 700 indigenous leaders occupied the country's House of Representatives to stop the nomination process for the Special Committee on PEC 215, approving the demarcation of traditional lands. This is a really cool one. The Little School of Liberty, the Escuelita de Libertad. I guess I could just know that without reading it. The Zapatista's first organizing school. They invited in any indigenous or solidarity activists to come to their community, their rebel community that's been living mostly in autonomy for years, doing a lot of this front-end work in retaining culture, in resisting assimilation and all of that. Originally, the group allotted for only 500 students. This is from Intercontinental Cry. But so many people wished to enroll that they opened an additional 1,200 slots for the week-long school. While attending the Escuelita, students lived with a family in a rebel Zapatista community and participated both in the school and in the daily life of the community. This year, the EZLN also announced the creation of a traveling indigenous seminar to provide a forum in which the indigenous peoples of the continent can be heard by those who have an attentive and respectful ear for their word, their history, and their resistance. The Matse people decided not to translate their traditional medicine encyclopedia to English or Spanish, to support their preservation of their language. Lots of the specific thing I wanted to focus on, not a lot of these stories are about it, are about resistance to resource extraction. Red Sucker Lake First Nation delivered a stop work order to Mega Precious Metals Inc. in northern Manitoba. And it held. Matthias Colom First Nation issued a similar order to Hud Bay Mining and Smelting, also in Manitoba. The Tatlan people celebrated a decision by Fortune Minerals to halt mineral exploration activities on Clapham Mountain inside the Sacred Headwaters region of northern British Columbia, Canada. This came through Spokane, a pilgrimage of hope. Five carvers from the Lummi Nation set on a journey up the Pacific Northwest, sending a message of Kwel Hoy, or we draw the line, to the resource extraction industry. There's more coming together. Preserving history, preserving language. The Sailor School in Spokane, still going strong. Learning more, solidarity. I got to interview T.R. McKenzie on this show, who works in North Dakota, trying to preserve, preserve the culture there, that's threatened by liquor incursion that violates treaties, and also working on fossil fuel resistance. And the place where these last two stories intersect, is that a ton of these indigenous activists are women, and that overlaps with our feminism issue. There's a really good, it's on popularresistance.org, an article with Widia La Riviere. Sorry, my French pronunciation is not good, Widia. She is a 29-year-old woman living in Montreal. She grew up, her mother is Anishinaabe, indigenous there, and her father is Quebecois, French-Canadian. And she was an instigator in Idle No More. And she talks about being a young woman in this kind of resistance work. And we'll read you this part of it. Actually, I have enough time. I didn't think I did. She answers the question, how have the problems of the communities you work, are there differences between women and men? She said, Indigenous peoples in Canada have lived a long history of colonization and oppression. The impacts and traumas of this history can still be felt and seen today. They live in marginalization, segregation, and exclusion. For decades, high-level government inquiries, federal audits, and international human rights bodies have repeatedly and consistently pointed to an unacceptable gap between Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples in the enjoyment of basic human rights. Despite living in one of the world's wealthiest countries, Indigenous families and communities in Canada continue to face widespread impoverishment, inadequate housing, food insecurity, ill health, and unsafe drinking water. They also face different types of racism and discriminations. Indigenous women also often face double discrimination. They are discriminated as Indigenous and as women. According to several studies and statistics, Indigenous women are 4 times more likely to experience violence than non-Indigenous women. Also, the number of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls in Canada is disproportionately high. More than 600 Indigenous women have gone missing or have been murdered in Canada over the last 2 decades. Indigenous and human rights organizations, as well as the United Nations, demand a national inquiry on this phenomenon. The current injustices that Indigenous women face specifically are due to the patriarchy brought with colonization. Before the Native peoples were colonized by the Europeans, Native communities were, for the most part, egalitarian. Women actively participated in social, economic, and political decision-making in their daily lives. That's why the Idle No More movement is mostly led by women that want to promote the leadership of Aboriginal women, which is not recognized anymore in the current colonial political system. Bam. I want to empower not only myself, but the whole community. Besides the youth, everyone plays a key role in the balance and well-being of our community. For example, youth need to engage a deeper intergenerational dialogue with elders who provide us with guidance, wisdom, and traditional teachings. I will also post this whole interview, which is longer and very cool. So, wow, that time flew by. Thanks for sticking with me. I'm going to talk next week more about the coming year. This is the past year. Some seeds that have been planted, some groundwork that's been done, some good work done by the state and by the economic status quo to disillusion folks and prep them further for what comes next, which is hopefully not going to be more of the same, because it's getting boring, it's getting more destructive, and we should just quit it. So we'll see how that goes. I'm going to play again. I was introduced to this awesome speech by Dwayne Cooper, who was on the show a few weeks ago. Thanks, Dwayne. I'm going to play your favorite speech again. This is Charlie Chaplin in the Great Dictator, his first speaking role in a film. And this is what he decided to say. Thanks for listening. You're listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM.
I'm sorry, but I don't want to be an emperor. That's not my business. I don't want to rule or conquer anyone. I should like to help everyone if possible. Jew, Gentile, black man, white. We all want to help one another. Human beings are like that. We want to live by each other's happiness, not by each other's misery. We don't want to hate and despise one another. In this world, there's room for everyone, and the good earth is rich and can provide for everyone. The way of life can be free and beautiful, but we have lost the way. Greed has poisoned men's souls, has barricaded the world with hate, has goose-stepped us into misery and bloodshed. We have developed speed, but we have shut ourselves in. Machinery that gives abundance has left us in want. Our knowledge has made us cynical, our cleverness hard and unkind. We think too much and feel too little. More than machinery, we need humanity. More than cleverness, we need kindness and gentleness. Without these qualities, life will be violent, and all will be lost. The aeroplane and the radio have brought us closer together. The very nature of these inventions cries out for the goodness in men, cries out for universal brotherhood, for the unity of us all. Even now, my voice is reaching millions throughout the world, millions of despairing men, women, and little children, victims of a system that makes men torture and imprison innocent people. To those who can hear me, I say, do not despair. The misery that is now upon us is but the passing of greed, the bitterness of men who fear the way of human progress. The hate of men will pass, and dictators die, and the power they took from the people will return to the people. And so long as men die, liberty will never perish. Soldiers, don't give yourselves to brutes. Men who despise you, enslave you, who regiment your lives, tell you what to do, what to think, and what to feel, who drill you, diet you, treat you like cattle, use you as cannon fodder. Don't give yourselves to these unnatural men, machine men with machine minds and machine hearts. You are not machines. You are not cattle. You are men. You have the love of humanity in your hearts. You don't hate. Only the unloved hate. The unloved and the unnatural. Soldiers, don't fight for slavery. Fight for liberty. In the 17th chapter of St. Luke it is written, the kingdom of God is within man. Not one man nor a group of men, but in all men, in you. You, the people, have the power. The power to create machines. The power to create happiness. You, the people, have the power to make this life free and beautiful. To make this life a wonderful adventure. Then in the name of democracy, let us use that power. Let us all unite. Let us fight for a new world. A decent world. That will give men a chance to work, that will give youth a future and old age a security. By the promise of these things, brutes have risen to power. But they lie. They do not fulfill that promise. They never will. Dictators free themselves, but they enslave the people. Now let us fight to fulfill that promise. Let us fight to free the world, to do away with national barriers, to do away with greed, with hate and intolerance. Let us fight for a world of reason. A world where science and progress will lead to all men's happiness. Soldiers, in the name of democracy, let us all...